Welcome to the Digital Forester Podcast, where we speak to forestry leaders and innovators who are shaping the future of forestry. Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Digital Forester Podcast. Today, I am joined with Domenico Yanni DiNardo, who is the CEO of Strategic, and also Aaron Fujikawa, who is the Director of Remote Sensing and Geomatics. How are you guys doing today?
Top notch, what a treat.
Yeah, fantastic.
I have to ask, why are you guys smiling? Is there some event that happened last night that is bringing you both joy?
Well, we don't want to timestamp this podcast too much, but certainly on the ice, things have been going pretty well here in the middle of June. But otherwise, I think we're just happy to have this opportunity to be innovative by having two of us on your podcast, which I understand is a rare event.
Absolutely. So it's rare we get a double treat on the pod. So we're going to have some fun here. And for our viewers, these lads are well set up. We can see both at the same time versus other ones where we've had multiple faces on the screen popping up at completely random times. So thanks for joining. It's super cool. Yes, go Oilers for those that are Oilers fans, and super fun time for Edmonton and Alberta. Where am I reaching both of you right now?
Yeah, you're reaching us in our Nanaimo, British Columbia office here on Stenamic First Nation territory. And it's a beautiful day, and we hope to see you out here someday again, Kevin.
100%. So customary with the podcast, I always start the conversation getting to know people's journey on how they got here. So maybe, Domenico, I'll start with you. We've chatted in the past, but maybe walk us through how you got to be where you are now, your journey in forestry and all that fun stuff. Was mom and dad a forester, and that was the connection? But maybe share with us your journey, and then I'll go over to Aaron after that.
Yeah, sure. I'll start a little ways back, but yes, second generation in the forest sector in Canada anyway. My father came over from Italy, and he was raised on a farm. He liked farming, and he just wanted to try something different. And what was the biggest thing he could harvest? Well, it was the timber here on the west coast of Canada. And he did that for 44 years. He's happily retired now, picking mushrooms and doing that sort of thing. And that got me into it almost 30 years ago now myself. And spent a couple decades plus working for large forest companies, doing all sorts of things within there. Chief forester, government relations, planning. And this opportunity came up here at Strategic Natural Resource Group, which has allowed me to diversify into more of the other sectors as well. So it's been a great 10 months so far here at Strategic, for which I was a client for many years in my other roles, and looking forward to getting this innovation and really demonstrating how some of the skills from the forest sector can be used in the other sectors.
For sure. So trained forester and moved up the ranks with various organizations, most recently, I believe, at Mosaic there. So for sure. So for Aaron, how about yourself? Second generation forester as well? Different story, different path?
Yeah, a little bit of a different story, different path. My background is in geography and GIS, so geographical information systems. But oddly enough, my father, he grew up in the forest industry. He actually helped run a few sawmills, build a few sawmills in the Okanagan, had a remanufacturing plant, was a log broker at one point as well. So I do have a bit of experience in the forest industry as a child. But after university, got a degree in geography, saw this great technology called GIS, got really switched on with that, and haven't looked back really. Started my own company in about 2000, started my own company, ran that for about 10 years, and then had the opportunity to join Strategic. And so last almost 15 years been with Strategic, and it's been a great ride since then. So that's my background.
Very cool. And so did both of you know each other before coming or joining at Strategic, or was this didn't know each other and it just happenstance that both of you ended up where you are today?
Well, I think Domenico's profile was a little bit higher than mine in the forest
Oh.
industry here, on the island in
Infamous.
BC. So
Yeah.
I knew Domenico just through word of mouth and seeing things, emails and other things, because we did work for him as our client. So yeah, no, didn't really know each other, but it's been a great last year, being able to work together since
Oh
we've
yeah, we live in the same neighborhood now, and just can't imagine life out here in Fujikawa, to be honest there, Kevin. It's been great and reassuring to know some of the faces behind some of the great work Strategic had put out when I was a client, and now
Nice.
I'm working
Nice.
with them. Great.
Good stuff. Good stuff. So maybe introduce me to Strategic Natural Resource Group. To be honest with you, I have no idea what Strategic does. So I'm equally excited to learn about all the cool, great things you're doing. But maybe walk me through maybe where Strategic came from, and then we'll go from there in terms of some of the work that you do.
Yeah, I was happy to talk about Strategic and its history. Late 2002, early 2003, there was quite a variety of change-ups on the coast of British Columbia in the forest industry, similar to kind of what's happening in the interior of British Columbia now with licensees changing up and rearranging. But what happened there was a group of forest engineering professional types, foresters and engineers and techs, were able to consolidate into a consulting group that was providing services back to the major licensees that had typically relied on internal resources for some of those planning services. And they soon discovered that they were specialists in, making somewhere out of nowhere and getting roads and access, primary access into tough places, tough environments, and working that into their general forestry planning and support services. The other resource sectors around that time started to additionally appreciate the skills that Strategic had for getting to those tough places quickly and safely that others couldn't get to. So the mining sector, and particularly the run-of-river sector, was big around that time. And that showed Strategic power of LIDAR for some of the things the run-of-river people were using. And certainly, Kevin, you're a guru on LIDAR, and what Strategic was able to do is to repurpose that, and it's still part of our culture today, was to deploy that type of technology back into the forest sector for real operational benefits. And as a client at the time, we were relying on Strategic to help teach us about LIDAR, and we could immediately start to see the benefits of that. So it's been a nice stepwise iteration for Strategic, focusing on its core in forestry, but developing into other sectors and helping pipelines get built, power lines get built, and supporting mines and other tricky access that goes with that. So that mentality and that nimbleness translated in having multi-powered special operations people that can do spill response when something happens on the water out here. Or now we have this fire response department that supports wildfire for the province and other provinces as needed. And then finally, as that journey, we've been doing that firefighting and spill responding for 15 or 20 years of the 23 years we've been around. 3 years ago, an Indigenous majority ownership happened. So we continue to be employee-owned, but now we're also Indigenous majority-owned, which makes it a very interesting combination and unique place for the company to function and support larger companies. And then as these large tenures on public land in the province get redistributed, we'll be working with smaller licensees, smaller tenure holders, and helping them make the most of all the technology that's out there.
Very cool, very cool. And so you touched on West Coast, BC, and being Indigenous majority owned. Can you maybe for our listeners and viewers bring us up to speed in terms of what the BC forestry market looks like today, and whether it's smooth sailings, which I know that's not the case, but maybe what some headwinds are, but maybe to level set our listeners that might be coming from other jurisdictions around the world, what forestry means or looks like in British Columbia?
Yeah, sure. I'll take a start at it, and then Aaron can jump in. But Globally, Canada and British Columbia are unique with having a very large proportion of public land. And historically, particularly after World War II, there was a model constructed where there would be large licensees connected to sawmills. They would manage large tracts of land and large unionized labor workforces and towns and communities would flow from that. That certainly worked for a long time, didn't necessarily reflect the rights of Indigenous peoples very well at all. That's been over the last 20 years being reconciled slowly, but it's happening. And combining that with just changing from the old growth conversion to second growth, harvest levels have generally decreased, sawmills have become more efficient. And then, of course, the international trade hiccups, to say the least, with the United States makes that uncertainty even higher for large licensees. So you see, particularly in the interior, where we have a large operation out of our Prince George location and the Peace area, Port St. John, the licensees are in transition. Tenures are being divided and returned to First Nations ultimately. And that is an opportunity and an uncertainty that Strategic is very busy working to make the most of and make sure our clients and prospective clients understand that there are many options in terms of just pure professional horsepower, but also new technology that our clients can benefit from and share some of the risk with and rewards with.
For sure, for sure. So sounds like tumultuous times, and yet some uncertainty, maybe the new world order, but still opportunity. The glass is half full, lots there. So maybe Aaron, as the director of remote sensing and geomatics, maybe give us the lay of the land in terms of what are some of the technology offerings that Strategic is involved with, and maybe some of the history of it, how you got to be. I know you mentioned you discovered GIS and geography. I can resonate with that story. It's a common one, maps, and like we start nerding out on the maps, and then naturally, believe it or not, a lot of people in Envirosci geography end up in forestry, and that's maybe a side conversation of maybe we just chose the wrong career path from the get-go, and could have had a shorter journey to where we ended up here. But maybe walk us through in terms of what are some of the tech that Strategic's involved with, and maybe some of the things that you manage within your portfolio.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think, speaking to some of the challenges in the forest industry, obviously, technology can play a part in providing solutions there, I think, for our clients and then for the industry in general. With like a bit of the history of Strategic, our ownership has always been on board with technology and innovation and trying new things and taking calculated risks in that way. Obviously, starting off in switching from traditional methods of doing layout to moving towards using iPads and GPS systems, taking operational mapping to another level, using the available technology that's slowly progressed over time. I mean, you're familiar with obviously a lot of the GIS technology in the work that you're doing. Our paths has obviously come on in the last number of years. These are drones, if for people that don't know the terminology, our paths. Some of the things that we're doing, in this area is really trying to, solve problems for our clients at the end of the day. We're doing things around, more timely dissemination of information for our clients, collecting data in different ways than we normally used to do traditionally, all sorts of different, aspects there, in the LiDAR realm. Using remote sensing, looking at some of the new technology coming out, but primarily, we use a lot of solve a lot of problems using geographical information systems. So we're building dashboards. Essentially, we're a data collection company at the end of the day. So we're trying to take data and information from the field, bring that into our in-house. Manage that information, transform it into information that then our teams can use for their analysis, and then provide that information to our clients at the end of the day, for them to make their decisions and drive their business forward. So we've got a portal technology that we're using right now, like I say, to build dashboards, web applications for our clients and our teams to access. You talked a little bit about or some of the newer terminology like digital twins. So we're starting to compile a lot of information on the land base, bring that into our systems, and integrate a lot of information there and feed that out to our teams. We're taking things like traditionally that were done with paper cards or in fillable PDFs, and we're now taking that database offline, bringing it out into the field to have a much more rich data collection environment for our teams for when they're in the field that way. Obviously, we're popping up drones in the air, collecting imagery, collecting LiDAR data for use in our in our planning. Waste and residue applications, silviculture, all sorts of different areas that we're trying to innovate and move away from traditional methods of doing this type of work and trying to find ways to find those efficiencies, save time, provide a much better quality product for our clients at the end of the day.
Very cool. And so I know you touched on just at the start, Aaron, that from the get-go with strategic, there is a sense of innovation, of not being afraid of new technologies, embracing them. Where did that come from? Was that really more the leadership side, or is that just baked into the culture from day one? But how would you describe that view? Because as you guys know in forestry, not all companies are forward leaning, might be the best way of putting it. So the fact that that was something built in or codified in the early days of strategic, where do you think that came from, or why did that come to be for you?
Yeah, no, definitely. It really came about through our ownership. John and Nels, who are our original owners, those two individualities really fostered a culture of innovation, of using technology. And I think it was a way for them to, being a new company, get above the competition, stay ahead of the competition, provide that extra value to the client that some forestry companies, some probably till to this day don't necessarily look at technology, like you say, in the same way that perhaps our ownership did at the time. So for me, that was a real emphasis when I came on with the company. That's the reason they actually brought me onto the company at the time, was because they felt a gap in their GIS systems and some of that technology there. And so we're looking for solutions at that point in time. And yeah, no, it's definitely can put it at the feet of ownership and the culture
Right.
they've developed.
Right. And so, Domenico, from your seat as CEO, looking at the things, the services, the technologies that Aaron described that strategic provides, what would you say are the top three, or have been the top three? And are those in your seat, I guess, as CEO, the right top three? And if not, what are areas that you would be providing leadership and moving the ship to focus on?
Yeah, no, our top three things certainly I would say are getting the data itself and second as efficiently as possible. Secondarily is to take that data and display it as commonly as possible. So a lot of people, most people are normal and aren't thinking about this stuff all the time like we are. So thankfully, technology that is rendering all of this data has kept up with the acquisition technology. And with the shrinking of tenure sizes, the proponents of these forests will just mathematically, statistically, have lower capabilities, lower in-house staff capacities, and will need proportionally more help per hectare in interpreting this type of information. So we reassure clients that they don't have to take all of these risks themselves. They can rely on us to increasingly make it more useful for, in the instance of British Columbia, the forest landscape planning processes, which has been recently reset to not just include forestry, but to include all the other natural resources much more explicitly in the planning processes, and the indigenous values that previous development planning processes just didn't have. And thirdly, what makes us different in our value proposition is, you know, we have 150 full-time staffers. We swell with fire season. And like I said earlier, these are multi-purpose, special task force type of people that will do spills, fires, forestry in between, mine site, road design. We have that response capability with the same people who know what the management objectives are for the land base and the ability to get there fast. So we have the gear, we have the expertise, and we can safely bring all that planning nice and organized whenever we can be. And then when something hits the fan, we're ready to go catch it, clean up, put the fire out, pick up the spill, move on, start again, and get back to planning to avoid those types of things in the future.
Right. And so you mentioned strategic being in the 150 person headcount range. It just jogged my memory, or not my memory, that doesn't work these days anymore, but there's this common narrative when we talk to people in our space that they can't find the right talent. At 150 headcount, you're clearly finding the right talent, keeping them in and growing from what I understand. Is there a disconnect there? What are your thoughts when we hear about, you know, certain forestry companies, forestry firms saying, you know, the talent's just not out there, and yet you have a strategic sitting at 150 and growing. Are we misadvertising the opportunities? Are we not communicating well enough the art of the possible? What are your thoughts on there, maybe from the CEO seat, and then I'll get Aaron's view from the technology leader point of view.
Yeah, just from the seat of trying to make sure we get that talent we need to keep that culture alive, where you're celebrated for trying, you're also celebrated for the occasional failure, but you're guaranteed a high variety working at a company like Strategic. And there are a good number of motivated, technically trained, or professionally trained people out there that will come to a company like Strategic if we keep reaffirming that promise that they'll get the experience they want, they'll get the exposure they want, and you know, get the benefits and the culture that makes sense for them wherever they are, you know, in Western Canada. Basically, we can generally bring those people in, be they office-based jobs or in particular for our proposition to recruitment, is that we've got all this interesting field opportunity combined with technology for gathering the data that they can deploy. And they can also then help communicate with clients or the public or government or the nations, depending on who the stakeholders are for particular projects. That is not to say that we, by any means, as an industry, forest industry, or more broadly for Strategic Natural Resource Group, the natural resource industry, should ease up on the throttle at all in terms of promoting the coolness of the job, where you're inside and outside, and you get to see things no one else has seen. You get to plan management of those precious resources for the benefit of the world. And not many jobs, not many lines of work offer that sort of direct connection to the big issues of climate change and population and healthcare and health. So it gets me excited. And it seems to help us get our recruits excited and keep our company full of the veterans as they increase their tenure with us.
Nice, nice. Aaron, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, you think of forestry and you think of, you know, guys with axes going out into the bush and, you know, harvesting trees or, you know, using their compass and things like that. But you know, obviously the industry is highly technical. It's got a lot of technology baked into it now at this point in time. I think one of the things that attracts people to our teams is the technology, certainly on the GIS side and the remote sensing and RPAS side that we do. You know, we're able to provide the opportunity for young people to come in and use the latest technology, you know, get skills in those areas. I mean, right now we have teams out, you know, from our group that are out scanning wildfires with drones using thermal imagery, you know, at night, you know, exciting type of work, you know, for you know, the individuals that come on here. I mean, we have training programs here within the organization to get certified for drone flights and get competencies and up to speed there. Also on the GIS side, we're going to start implementing a GISP certification, kind of a path there, and helping out, young professionals there in that area, to get that certification. So, and we're continually, assessing our technology and updating it, and really supporting those individuals in terms of mentoring and their technical skills and capabilities. So, young people nowadays, they're familiar with technology. I think they expect to have some level of technology in the work that they do. And so I think we can satisfy, that for individuals. And then, our senior people too. I mean, technology and GIS and all this kind of industry, it's always changing. The technology is changing so rapidly. So even our senior people, they're constantly getting exposed to new technology, new systems, and things like that, which keeps them switched on also.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. And so when we think about innovation, it's a nice word. Sometimes people might say buzzword, but rarely does it ever go in a straight line. Often maybe we end up making a few circles or maybe multiple circles in the same spot. So as a company that invests in innovation and deals with innovative technologies, how would you describe how Strategic goes about tackling a new innovation project? So maybe thinking about one of your more recent innovation projects, what tell me more about that journey. How do you start that? How do you make sure the CEO of Strategic is happy and checking the boxes for him sitting across the table there? Tell me more about how you guys go about executing an innovation project and then maybe converting that into an actual service offering for your customers.
You want me to tackle that
Yes,
one,
you start it in,
or
then I'm gonna see if you can get
yeah,
to the
yeah.
next one.
Well, as you know, it's always a challenge when you're trying to innovate and develop new technology. And we're not necessarily developing new technology. I think it's more of we're implementing the technology that's available, things that are coming online, applying that for our clients and for our teams internally. And you probably know this very well, Kevin. You need that stakeholder engagement, right? You need to be able to, look across the company, see a need, look at your clients, engage those individuals, and say, here's something that we need. I think we need to look at. We need to, plan for this. We need to be proactive in keeping up with technology, in that regard. So certainly, stakeholder engagement is a big one at the very beginning. Looking at the different technology that you might be wanting to implement or the innovation that you want there. And it doesn't always have to be technology. It could just be a new workflow or a new procedure, something like that that creates efficiencies or manages people's time better, automates processes. So it's a matter of just sitting down, looking at that issue or that challenge, involving the stakeholders. And then at that point, once you get the stakeholder buy-in, it's really you're now into a planning process where you're starting to look at, researching the different avenues that could take, what kind of pieces of technology might you need. And then, coming up with a plan, for that budgeting scope, what are you going to be, what are your actual objectives and goals of, for doing this? And then basically getting approval from somebody like Domenico saying, yep, you know what, that looks good. Let's move ahead with that. And then, again, accounting for the challenges that you're going to have. You're going to have roadblocks. You're going to come up with issues with the technology where you got to step back and maybe take a different direction. And I think a lot of it is sort of being flexible too at the same time, and adjusting course as you get feedback from end users, as you look at some of the technological challenges that you come across while you're doing this. Expect failures once in a while where things don't go the way you planned. But at the end of the day, I think it's a matter of working as a team together, all aspects of the organization coming together to support the project and that innovation, and then getting to that end goal.
Yeah, for me, clearly, there are two types of demand. There's the demand that we have heard and know from our clients, potential clients, and then there's the demand that we need to create in some of these projects. Certainly, things like ultra heavy lift drones for water delivery on fires, that's something that people haven't thought much about. So the demand is an iterative process and managing, informing, testing the scenarios, making sure people agree that there's a space for this type of technology. And on the risk assessment side of that new technology rollout as well, in some cases need to literally know where these services can get shot down. I mean, we're good at linear developments. We're good at using LiDAR to replace ground-based site surveys. One of our drones was recently shot at by an unhappy neighbor who had no right to be unhappy, but certainly no right to be shooting at it. And we got to start thinking about putting AI to use to start detecting that sort of silhouette in the scope site, so we can avoid those scenarios. So there's all those things that we learn along the way, and the team is disciplined at reporting those learnings so that we put it into our hopper and regularly review it.
Yeah, for sure. So maybe let's double click. There's a couple of things I've listened to you both touch on. So maybe we'll double click on them. So RPAS, what does it stand for? Domenico, you've touched on the heavy lift drones and different use cases. So maybe bring me along the journey in terms of strategic thinking of drones, pilots, maybe the technology development internally. But maybe what's RPAS first? And then what do drones mean, or UASs or UAVs mean to strategic today? And then we'll go into the future.
Yeah, well, they're remotely piloted aircraft systems. So that's sort of the acronym, the full meaning of the acronym there. Yeah, we started our program in drone use. Now drones are more common name for them now, because these acronyms could get confusing and they're changing all the time. But our drone program started back in 2015. Again, culture of innovation here at Strategic, and looking to find solutions for our clients. And the technology was just starting to come on around then. I mean, I think drones had been around for a few years before that, but we started to see them sort of really coming to the forefront there. A lot of buzz about them at the time. So we took a closer look at those and started to work towards getting our certification with Transport Canada. Back in the time, you needed to actually have an SFOC, a Special Flight Operations Certificate, to operate drones. That's changed a little bit now. And so we started, working with, custom-built drones back in 2015, 2016, and then we started to, move into some of the DJI-type products, fully manufactured, supported products that weren't customized. And really, we were looking at them to solve solutions in forestry, right? That was kind of the key thing. Like, what can we do with these systems that will allow us to stay ahead of the competition, but also allow us to solve those problems for our clients? And start to innovate again in how we collect data, providing a different perspective, a different type of data that we normally don't, have access to, and try to put us ahead of the curve in the industry. And so, now today we've got, about six different machines. We have two M300s, we have two M350s. These are DJI systems. We have two vertical takeoff and landing fixed wings Wingtra systems, and then we have multiple Mavic Minis and Mavic Pros. So we're primarily using these now. One example, obviously, fire scanning in that aspect. We're now flying LiDAR with these as well. So we're looking at stand level LiDAR data collection. We're looking at road corridors. We're using these for, like I mentioned before, waste and residue. We're looking at them for silviculture surveys, all sorts of different aspects now for our organization, with these systems. And they're just going to become more prevalent. I mean, we don't see anything changing in the industry. We just see it kind of moving forward. We've got 12 advanced pilots now in our organization, a lot of basic pilots that are certified. We have our Beyond Visual Line of Sight SFOC. We're working towards our remotely piloted aircraft system operator certificate. There's a bunch of new changes coming forward from Transport Canada that's really going to open up more opportunity for the use of drones in all industries. And so, we're just staying on the forefront of this technology and integrating it as much as we can into the work we do.
Yeah, so when we think about beyond visual line of sight flights now, are we at a point now where literally you can just kind of launch it, set it, forget it, program it, and let it rip? Or are there still constraints within the Canadian regulatory framework that, yeah, it's kind of beyond visual line of sight, but not really? What can you tell us or educate us on that front?
Yeah, no, it depends on the type of operation that you're doing. If you're doing an advanced operation with BVLOS, meaning that, there's higher risk level to that operation, You have to get a special flight operations certificate, which we do have for the beyond visual line of sight for our fire scanning work that we do, because we are sending these systems at night where you can't really see them anyways, far off into the distance and doing our work there. More backcountry type work is going to be starting to come online a bit more, where you're not needing that BVLOS certification for that. That this is all getting into the RPAS operator certificate and the level one pilot certification that's coming out. It varies depending upon the type of operation but the regulations at this point certainly are changing, and I think Transport Canada is starting to get more comfortable with drones. But at the same time, increasing that regulatory environment to a certain degree, to be able to, be safe, have safe operations, and ensure that, companies that like us that are doing this commercially are doing it by the book.
Right. So recognizing that CEOs tend to be very impatient people and always want everything yesterday, I'm assuming that your colleague sitting on across the table there has other grand plans in terms of drone technology. What can you share with us? I know you kind of alluded to it, I think, a bit in the heavy lift drone work, but maybe share with us, our listeners, our viewers, what where Strategic sees the world of UAVs, UASs, drones going.
Yeah, certainly. For us, we see them, being deployed further beyond visual sight in the future, and those sorts of extensions will happen. The lift capacity, though, is the next level for actual actioning of emergencies in particular, but also other work. So we've partnered up with a company called FireSwarm Solutions. So FireSwarm is a group of aeronautical type engineering types that have gotten together with a company called ACC out of Sweden, and they've produced a large ultra heavy lift drone that's been working there for a few years, helping out with the Swedish government and industrial maintenance and delivery type of work. And it made perfect sense to us that have spent many years working fire lines, spent time on shorelines by lakes with lots of water in it, and fires going up on the hillside waiting for aircraft to come, particularly when the fire is small, which is how they all start. Understanding that this technology was there, we're so comfortable with drones and operations and deployments of them at Strategic for spills and hotspot mapping, for instance, as well as our day-to-day, it made sense for us to start exploring this. So the idea has now got BC Wildfire Service endorsement. They're helping with the testing. The testing has been happening, even as we speak here now in late spring 2025. And the idea of not just one of these drones operating, autofilling at a water body and deploying on a hotspot, but integrating and communicating between multiple of these Thunder Wasp drones, they're called, and having a swarm, a happy swarm, doing its good work of bringing water up to the hillside, which is what we want these types of machines to do, and supplements our ground crew that is often on these fires, waiting, just sleeping at night or spotting for what can be done in the morning as soon as daylight comes. Now, we believe this complements the ground crews and the existing expertise to make fires stop sooner. And when we get all of these certificates that we're helping work with FireSwarm and Transport Canada approved, there'll be some certain type of certifications. We'll start with the Class F airspace where nobody's out there, and at night when there's not much other air traffic around, so that the airspace is free for these drones to do their thing. And once people see this happening and the testing is clear, the machine is doing this in Sweden, they're working to be faster at producing these machines. They're going to be here sometime late this year or early next year. And I'm confident that Strategic, like it's done on the early LiDAR work and other spill response use of drones, will keep that culture alive and even build on it and help show customers, clients, First Nations, small communities in particular, that there are these options around to pre-position these types of responses. And when they're not actioning emergencies, they're acting as cranes. They're lifting things around that are otherwise awkward for helicopters or conventional cranes on the ground, because they work at night. They're not breathing in horrible smoke, particulates all day long. It's just a natural evolution in my mind, Kevin.
Yeah, yeah. Now, did you say the drone was called a Thunder Wasp?
That's right. Yeah, that's when they
Interesting.
take the, yeah, that's when it's kitted out with the fire mission kit, so that it can deal with the 400-liter Bambi bucket and the appropriate sensors, the heat sensors, the mesh communications, and probably a parachute for that bad day to make sure it doesn't get any worse if something goes wrong. But these are twin turbine quadcopters that they're about 800 pounds tear weight, and they'll be able to lift, I'll keep it in metric here, they'll be able to lift 400 kilos of payload and
wow.
run for over an hour on a fueling. So our crew is good at getting these things to site, helping deploy them when they're there, and training other operators to use them when there's that level of demand.
Yeah, I love it. So as long as it has power, it's never going to tire out. It's just going to keep going back to replenish and keep
Yes.
dropping. Very cool. Very cool.
Yeah,
Yeah.
that's true. Of course, there's always a maintenance ecosystem that we need to establish for this type of new technology.
True.
Between a regular drone and a helicopter, and that's not in Canada yet, but we're certainly talking to the people that will make that happen. So there will be a technician and a maintenance program that has to come with machines of this
Right.
size.
Right. Sounds like very cool technology. So as Aaron being on the tech side, I'm sure it's lots of new toys that you get to play with. So thinking of traditional to the Digital Forester podcast, we always talk about trends, and I get our folks who join us to kind of maybe future cast into what the art of the possible is. So in both of your seats, I guess, what are you guys seeing for tech trends or market trends, and any of them keeping you up at night, or is it more excitement? Maybe I'll start, Aaron, with you. What are you seeing trend wise, whether it's from a technology or business point of view, in the space of forestry and forestry technology?
Yeah, well, I think that looking at what Domenico mentioned earlier was 10 years are going to be changing. We're going to see a lot, maybe perhaps more smaller landowners, 10-year holders taking over this. So I think there's a huge opportunity there to work with those individuals and organizations to help along with their technology, whether it be GIS or drone or RPAS side of things. I do think that, government regulations, I think, in terms of changing trends, I mean, governments are picking up more on this. They're doing more in terms of allowing this type of technology, whether it be RPAS or LIDAR, to start being used in decision making and those types of applications. So they're supporting that a lot more for sure. I see remote sensing. I mean, I think, we're recently seeing new satellites being deployed, to measure forests, look at infestation and things like that. I mean, those technologies have already sort of been there in the past, but I think the resolution and the capabilities of some of these new systems that are being deployed, are going to be changing, how we do some things, I think, in forestry. So keeping up on that. Certainly, I know opportunity around, data dissemination, bringing more information to the client, to individuals on your team that traditionally don't get to see maps, for instance, or use GIS technology. I think deploying a lot more, that for those individuals, I think, is going to be coming online. Application wise, you always say, it's kind of limitless or endless. I mean, there's lots of ideas, out there that, we can be looking at in terms of using, for instance, machine learning. I mean, we have drones in the air now collecting a lot of data, a lot of information. So looking more to those types of systems to help to analyze, provide data analysis, more information for our teams, I think is a big one there. And how we collect data. I think that's changing all the time as well. So certainly, I think there's a lot of opportunity for technology. But it really comes down to me, the development, working with people that are developing the technology, getting out there and finding out what's available, what's going to be the next new technology coming up, and staying, staying on that curve there.
Yeah, I would echo that. Certainly with the province of British Columbia committed to getting LIDAR across the province will help set a new base. It's happening. It's fairly low resolution, but that still is a step towards triggering companies like ours and other data collectors getting it into the, instead of the 9 points per square meter, into the 100 or 1,000 square points per meter that we can do with LIDAR. And the other trend is just the connectivity in everyone's hands. Your iPhone now can deal with some satellite messaging. It's going to get better, I'm sure, as long as you got a view of the sound, decent view satellite. So a lot of the technology that we're trying to deploy relates to safety of our actual workers that we want others to know about as well. We've pioneered a safety check-in system that allows us to utilize some of these new features and satellite connectivity that can be very efficient for other users of that technology without spending customized thousands of dollars. And that is something that we'll keep watching for.
Yeah, for sure, for sure. Thanks for sharing those thoughts. And so maybe another question for you, Domenico. As an ex-executive of Mosaic Force Corporation, again sitting at that reasonably high level, you got to view the world from a different lens, and now you're in a different seat, and again fortunate enough to view the world from a different lens as well. And so when you think about Strategic's service offerings, technology offerings to those large types of organizations, are there lessons learned maybe in terms of how to better engage with these large companies that sometimes they're like cruise ships? It takes a little time to get them to turn, but once they're going, they're going. Any pearls of wisdoms to share about that now that you've kind of gone to the other side, and not necessarily one side's better than the other, just you've had the benefit to sit on both sides?
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, let's talk about some pearls on this cruise ship of resource management. Yes, when you're dealing with large companies or governments, there's that communication pipeline that needs to be well understood, because there can often be multiple people in Strategic talking to multiple people at a major company or a government. Takes a lot of discipline for everyone to always know who's the final decision maker, who's a dispute resolution go-to. But ideally, you never get there because everybody knows what the mission is. Clearly, everybody understands what the costs of certain services are, what the results and benefits of each of those services are. And Strategic's been at this a long time. We've worked for the major companies in various parts of the province, Western Canada, at various levels. There are choices for those companies in terms of who provides pieces of the services that we provide. What we do to keep our clients is demonstrate the efficiency of the combined in-house service providers and expertise that we have here at Strategic to make it more efficient overall, and make them more comfortable from the increasing professional reliance trend, professional accountability, and governmental shifting of expectation to professionals within an even more complicated prescriptive environment. So you got both of these trends happening in the background, where licensees are going to have to show that they're as diligent as possible. Permit holders, mine site proponents, pipelines, they need to demonstrate that they were working with the most diligent and professional advisors they could find. And that's what Strategic aims to do. And we find that our clients appreciate it.
Awesome. Awesome. So as we look to wind down, maybe the last question I'll ask each of you, and I'll start, Aaron, with you, is that thinking of a younger Aaron, what pro tips, advice? What advice would you give him, given where you are in your career and the work that you do? Are there any pro tips you'd give the younger Aaron if you had the chance?
Yeah, no, definitely. I would say, one thing is, keep an open mind. Always be, looking for new technology, always be looking for a different way to do things, question what you're doing at all times. Kind of step back and see, okay, am I going down the right road here? I think that's a big one here. Certainly, I think, for me, I never went and got a master's or a PhD or things like you did at the time. But look, I've learned a lot from what, the education that I did get. But I would say, pursue that to a higher level. Like, push yourself, see how much farther you can go. Because certainly having that knowledge and knowledge base and education base there is something that's important. And I guess in hindsight, I wish I had maybe done a little bit more. But I'm happy where I am now. It's worked out very well for me. And then another thing would be just to keep persevering, I guess, and don't let roadblocks or things that get in your way get you down. And then also keep learning. I think keep having a mindset of continually learning, because as you're aware, technology and the industry that I'm in, any industry you might be in, changes very, very quickly. And so, keep an open mind and keep a learning mindset as you go throughout your career and your life.
Yeah, great, great. And it's never too late to do more school, like graduate school. And you could just ask the guy across the table to say, "Hey, I need some funding for my PhD, Domenico. Here we go." So there you have it. So what about you, Domenico? A younger self of you, what pearls of wisdom, pro tips, words of encouragement would you share with your younger self?
Yeah, it would be to have done more of that encouragement to de-silo the natural resource sector. I think we see regulations starting to appreciate the concept of cumulative effects. I was able to get the seeds of that concept from my schooling and my training, and spent quite a bit of time working to convince others around me of the importance of appreciating some crazy technology, for instance, that Strategic might have been brought over from the mining sector, and the benefits of that. So there's more of that to be done. So the younger me, if I'm coaching him to start his career now, is to celebrate that. And what I talk about with the quadruple bottom line is that particularly in Canada and British Columbia, the Indigenous expectations need to be constantly converted into the measurable, the professional, so that we can then reverse engineer it back into the types of renderings and maps and forecasts that those nations should rightfully have presented back to them in a meaningful way, so that they can weigh into the planning process. So I'm glad to see that is the general trend and that is happening, but it can happen faster, and I would encourage everyone to do their part in it.
For sure, for sure. Well, guys, I really appreciate you spending some time with me to kind of introduce myself and the listener and the viewership to Strategic Natural Resource Group and what you do and how you embrace innovation and how that translates into the services and the technology offerings that you have. So for our listeners and viewers that might want to follow up with you to learn more about what you do and how maybe they can benefit or subscribe to your services, what's the best way that they can get a hold of you? Aaron, on your side, what's the best way for someone to get in touch with you?
Yeah, I think just go to our website. We have our contact information on there, snrgroup.com. Just recently had that updated and refreshed with a lot of information on our services and contacts there. So I would recommend doing that, or reach out to me directly, aaron.fujikawa@snrc.ca. I don't know if you can spell that, I should spell that out or not, but I can also be reached through email as well.
Yeah, we can put those in the show notes as well. And Domenico, how about yourself? Or are you just going to give Aaron's email and say just contact him and it'll get to me?
Though I trust all the viewers and listeners of this podcast to make reasonable use of domenico@snrgroup.com. Send me a note, happy to see it. And to Aaron's point, there's a lot more info on our website, and you'll find us on all the social as well. So we are easy to get a hold of, and look forward to hearing ideas or questions from anybody smart enough to be listening to this podcast.
For sure, for sure. So there you have it, Digital Forcers. You have both Aaron and Domenico's email. Use them judiciously. And if you want more information, feel free to go ahead to the website there. So, well, guys, it was great chatting with you. Good seeing you again, Domenico. Looking forward to the next time we all connect together. Hopefully it'll be in person.
Thanks, Kevin.
Thanks, Kevin.
Awesome.
Appreciate it.
Take care.